As dawn breaks and morning light spreads from east to west, we'll be bringing you the breathtaking beauty of birdsong as it moves like a spectacular wave of sound across the face of the earth. So for the next 6 hours, we'll be coming to you live from Cuscany Marsh Nature Reserve here in Cove in County Cork on the south coast of Ireland. So please allow us to be your travel companions as we embark on this unique journey together, navigating our way right across the continent, allowing nature to be our guide. I'm joined here by ornithologist Jim Wilson and zoologist Dr. Richard Collins. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Derek, and it's a fantastic morning. This is the exciting part. We're getting the ball rolling, so to speak, on our marathon broadcast here from Cuscany Marsh. And all the mics are in place. The birds were singing while we were setting them up today. It's all nice and quiet now. Hopefully they're all resting their vocal cords for what will truly be an amazing and unique experience live on air from where we are here today.
Whatever happens, come hell or high water, as they say, the birds will sing. They depend on it for their survival.
Absolutely. As sure as the sun comes up every morning, the birds will sing.
Richard Collins, your thoughts?
I believe hearing our dawn chorus is one of the great wildlife experiences. And I happen to think, though I'm biased, that the one we have in Ireland is better than those anywhere else. We have something to really boast about, a wildlife experience second to none, the dawn chorus of Europe.
Well, thank you, Richard. And for the very first time in the history of the Mooney Goes Wild programme, millions of listeners right across Europe.
When the morning breaks and the light comes flooding down on all our lives and the air is singing, who sings the stars down from the darkness? Who sings the sun up into the morning? Who cracks open the dawn? Us, sing the blackbird and the thrush. Us, sing the red-breast robin. And us, sings the band of wrens singing in the fresh green branches. All join the dawn chorus.
For almost 30 years now, Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio 1 has broadcast, in some manner, shape or form, the sound of early morning birdsong. The dawn chorus has become a radio phenomenon, treasured by listeners in Ireland and, in recent years, further afield too, across Europe and the world. Let's go now to the Netherlands, to Radio Vara. Rob Booter. Hello, Rob. How are you?
Hi, Derek. How are you?
Very good this morning.
Very nice night here in the Biesbos. I'm here with forester Theo Muse, and we're actually very close to a blue throat singing on one end of the little alley that we're standing on. And on the other end, we hear two nightingales, Theo.
Yes, two nightingales, and there's a setch warbler as well, fully committing itself. So it's already started here.
Probably partly because it's such a clear sky. The moon is
yes,
very bright, so the birds must think it's almost morning already.
To the best of our knowledge, RTE was the first broadcaster in the world to celebrate this rich avian orchestral performance on such a large scale, beaming the entire live performance into people's homes, vehicles and workplaces. When we started, it seemed like a mad idea to some. Who on earth is going to listen to birds singing on the radio? And at a time when they would normally be asleep in bed? Well, the answer to that question, it transpires, is millions of people, as we discovered in 2016 when we broadcast our first European-wide dawn chorus under the umbrella of the European Broadcasting Union. And just like the Eurovision Song Contest, there were a few outliers, namely AIR, All India Radio, India's public service broadcaster.
Morning, Derek. Thank you very much indeed. It's a great pleasure to join the dawn chorus this time from the easternmost location I think you have in this broadcast. The dawn chorus here is in full swing. We've been waiting here for some time. The sun has not yet risen. It's going to rise at 5:35 local time. That's in another 15 minutes or so. But the sky has lightened and we really have the entire gamut of species over here joining into the dawn chorus.
And battalions of crows and mynas which are the Indian starlings, and they are now moving across the lightning sky, and this tremendous background sound that you hear are the miners now waking up and moving out to their feeding grounds.
Birdsong and radio almost seem made for each other. No other medium could showcase this natural phenomenon so effectively. The Dawn Chorus cuts across all social, national, and linguistic barriers. And the birds themselves also happen to be the most dependable radio performers of all. But despite this, every year when we start the live program, I can't help but feel a pang of anxiety. Will the birds let us down this year? They never, ever have. Come what may, they always sing. Now, I may have been the first person to consider broadcasting the Dawn Chorus on a large scale on radio, but the credit for celebrating the Dawn Chorus worldwide goes to writer, broadcaster and environmental campaigner Chris Baines.
In 1988, I decided that this was such a good idea that I would try and make it happen much more broadly. So I did the unforgivable thing of ringing Radio 4 Today programme and telling them that the first Sunday in May was going to be International Dawn Chorus Day. They ran that as a news story, and hey presto, if the BBC says it is, it is.
No fact-checking at that time.
Well, they'd have had a hard job to find any facts about it. But it's a great example of self-fulfilling prophecies, really. If you say these things will happen, then sometimes they do.
Chris Baines has many strings to his bow, not least of which is the fact that he is the person who first came up with the idea of International Dawn Chorus Day, celebrated on the first Sunday of May each year.
I've always loved the idea of waking up before dawn and hearing that amazing sound of the birds singing. It's been a part of my life forever. And it didn't really have any kind of celebration generally. And then on my 40th birthday, I thought, I am actually not going to see most of my friends for my birthday. The ones I could get there, I managed to drag to my garden at 4 a.m. to share in the Dawn Chorus and a glass of champagne. But I contacted lots of others to say, if it suits you, it would be great to think that you are listening to the Dawn Chorus wherever you are when I'm listening to it where
okay,
I am.
Yeah.
Whether they ever actually got up in the morning at 4 o'clock, I don't know. and I had enough friends. I remember we had somebody who'd won the BBC Wildlife Photographer of the Year Awards staying with us, and she went back to Denver. So the following year in Denver, there were two International Dawn Chorus Day events where they made more of it by making it a day when people with disabilities were gathered together to take them to two parks where they could listen to the Dawn Chorus. Slowly, the thing grew and grew and grew. And it's on everybody's doorstep, and anybody can do it. And many, many people do.
I think it's fair to say that the annual Mooney Goes Wild live Dawn Chorus broadcast has become something of an institution. Winner both of the National PPI Radio Award for Innovation and the coveted International Rose Door Award, the programme has become one of the broadcast highlights of the year.
This is a sound that our ancestors in Ireland would have been very familiar with. If you went back several centuries, when Ireland had a lot more forest cover than it does today, the capercaillie was a relatively well-known bird. I mean, it was obviously it's a lot of meat in it, so they were hunted for their food. But the real thing that was the death knell for them in Ireland was the deforestation. And being here in Norway and seeing the health of this pine forest here, I can see why we don't have them anymore. We just don't have woodland like this in Ireland.
That's actually the alpha male charging arrival slightly away from us to the west here now. It chased him down.
They're so aggressive.
And, oh, this female, one, this female, one, female. Female.
And male in hot pursuit behind her.
Playing up rather nicely in front of the microphone. The male is chasing her 3 or 4 meters behind her, dragging his wings, strutting his tail. And now he weird off to the left. And she's alone. She's looking after him.
getting ready for some action, I think. But he's more worried about his rival. He's taking off to the left, chasing some rival. There's another female flying in. Here it, oh, he's actually chasing the other female into the lake.
It's kicking off, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, look at that. Just a quick smash of the wings, throwing some snow up into the air and just herding us. His little female.
Derek, he is right in front of us. He's probably 7-8 meters away from us, strutting his stuff, tail fanned out. He's just a picture of avian perfection is what he is. He's incredible. And the ladies look impressed as well. They're strutting around, and they do this thing where they drag the wings along the ground to make the sound as well. And the white patches on the side of the body just really stick out. The light's coming up now for us. We can see him quite clearly. He's just showing his dominance. He's saying, this is my patch. I want all these females. Everyone else, get lost.
And if you could have a medical team standing at the ready, because if this gets any more exciting, Niall Hatch's eyes are going to pop out of his head.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it for a second. But what a good way to go.
Niall Hatch with Helge Sufteland, a nature presenter with NRK, Norway's National Broadcasting Service, on the sidelines of a capercaillie lek on a snow-covered mountain range on the west coast of Norway.
So for this category, the jury was looking for an innovative and major live radio event. In the judging process, my colleagues were extremely conscious of the gold standard of the Rose Door, and they found that only one entry had the level of ambition and impact to be nominated. The extremely worthy winner for the 2016 Rose Door Radio Event of the Year goes to the European Dawn Chorus, RTE Radio 1 from Ireland.
Each morning in spring and summer, as the first glimmer of daylight begins to dispel the darkness, millions of birds burst into song. But what exactly is the Dawn Chorus? And why do our songbirds perform in it? Each individual bird does this for two key reasons: to lay claim to a breeding territory, mainly by intimidating its rivals, and to attract a mate, by showcasing the volume, frequency, and quality of its song, demonstrating its fitness. The birds aren't singing for our benefit, but we benefit greatly nonetheless. The performers themselves can't know this, and indeed are completely indifferent to our thoughts on the matter. But to human ears, the collective effect is like nothing else in the world.
Hello, Terry, come on in. This is my office. This
very
is where
nice.
It all happens. And look, I love to have a globe in the office. It's a great psychological thing, a globe.
I always like looking at them because you see the earth or the world as it really is. You know, when you look at a map or you look at an atlas and you look at a country like Greenland, it looks huge. Yeah. But in reality, it's nowhere near as big.
Yes, it gives you perspective, a kind of comprehensive bird's eye view of the thing, kind of appropriate today. But anyway, this is my globe. I bought it many years ago for the children to further their education. Now it occupies a prominent place on my desk.
As Dr. Richard Collins puts it, the Dawn Chorus never ceases. It moves like a great wave across the face of the earth. At this moment, somewhere in the world, the birds are waking up and bursting into song. It's literally the sound of the earth rotating on its axis. An idea that fascinates both Terry Flanagan and Richard Collins.
It's not true to say, as you might think, that only the birds go in for choruses. Well, that isn't actually completely true. For instance, the gibbons in Borneo in the early morning, the gibbons and the racket they would be making, or the howler monkeys, I remember them in South America, out in the rainforest, and you'd hear them 5 kilometres away, and they sing in the morning. But there's a difference. The birds sing, but the chorus continues. It is an entity in itself. it moves across the face of the earth. It starts there and they take it up here and then they take it up further on and goes off and recedes into the distance. Whereas with the howler monkeys or the gibbons, it's just here. This tribe shouts and roars and maybe there's another tribe a few miles away, but it isn't a continuous worldwide thing. We wouldn't show gibbon choruses on the globe, for instance.
Well, coming back to the globe here, if we pick out Ireland, and we're at about 55 degrees north or 53 degrees north. We can see it here.
Yes.
And Richard, your torch. I see you have your torch here as
yes,
well.
Yes. What? Well, the other thing I want to say about choruses, we go in for choruses too. The Welshmen singing Land of My Fathers, it lifts the spirit, but it's a chorus of coming together, do you see? Our choruses are, where it's solidarity, love, not war, love of country in that case. But whereas with the birds, it's not love, it's war. They're all grabbing, trying to oust each other. So it's the very opposite, in a sense, of our choruses. But now, look here at the globe. Are you going to trace the movement here with your light or something?
Yeah, can we do that?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
So the sun rises in the east.
The sun shows up over the separate. Now, the dawn is an interesting thing, you know. Nobody can say what the dawn really is, do you see? For instance, the experts, the people who analyse these things, talk about the astronomical dawn. And the astronomical dawn is 18 degrees below the horizon. And then you have the next thing called nautical dawn, which is, of course, I believe it's around 12 degrees below the horizon. Now, that's defined as the level of light. It's not bright yet, but it's sufficiently bright to navigate a ship. That's why it's called nautical dawn. And then at 6 degrees below the horizon, you have civil dawn, do you see? Civil dawn, you can do everything, really. But it's still just dawn in the sense that Jupiter and Venus are visible still in the sky. But it is bright. And then, of course, you have sunrise, which is finally there. Now, the birds start up at the very earliest, some of them. The ones with the big eyes, the ones that live high up in the trees, start first, usually, because they see further away. And they sing and they get their recital over and then gradually other ones come in. So it takes a long time until the last stragglers, the latest ones up, the lazy heads, they're the last. So it's quite a long process. So if we start here, you might think the Atlantic would be a block to the flow, but I don't think it is. If you look at the way it goes, the dawn is moving out of Ireland into the open sea, so the birds will all shut up, won't they? Oh, not really, because they're still going in West Africa, in Senegal, Gambia, and places like that. They're still singing away, and they pass the relay on to the Cape Verdes next, you see. Or up further north, you have the Azores. Up further north, you have Iceland.
So, and then up to Greenland.
And then on to Greenland, and then on to
North America.
And remember the protrusion there of
South America. We're just looking at it here.
Brazil is jutting out there. Dakar is about 16 degrees west. The Cape Verde is about 17.5, I would say. So that's well within the powers of the dawn chorus to be continuous between those two places. Then it goes heading across the Atlantic to be taken up by the east coast Brazil, the extreme east coast. And you're looking at about 31, 32, 33 degrees there. So it is continuous.
Yeah.
Except, of course, we're now gone to the southern hemisphere. So it's not spring there, it's the opposite. But there's a chorus all year round of some sort. It's best in our part of the world in spring, of course, because we're constrained. The birds have to get on with it. They've only got a few weeks in which to do all their business and breed. So there's a concentrated dawn chorus. Towards the tropics, there's more time available. There's less variation summer and winter. So, and in the southern hemisphere. But there's still a chorus. I've heard it in these countries.
Birds know no boundaries, and their songs have the power to connect us all in a unique way, right across countries and continents. As it moves from east to west with the rising sun, the dawn chorus represents a genuine shared link between all of our world's people, transcending national borders and cultures.
Do you hear that, Blackbird? I hear that every single day. We don't know where he is or what tree he's on, but I just love nature and love everything around us. And I just like people to know that I like nature, because it's a good thing to have nature. Thank you very much.
My niece, Aveen, who loves nature. People love nature and have an intrinsic desire to feel a connection with it. Birdwatching is the fastest growing leisure activity in the world, and Europe alone is home to tens of millions of birdwatchers and nature enthusiasts. During COVID in particular, for thousands of people, the Dawn Chorus became a unique introduction to a wider natural world right on their own doorstep, of which they were previously unaware. It is an experience to which everyone can relate and in which everyone can share, no matter who they are or where they happen to be. Biologist Terry Flanagan.
My favourite place to bring the dog. Here on the banks of the Royal Canal, just past Clonsilla. I walk this spot almost every single day, and she loves it. It's so quiet and peaceful. But during COVID, it was a lot different, I can tell you. There were so many more people out. I presume they just needed to get out of the house. But so many people actually discovered the canal and what a beautiful amenity it was. They weren't just walking, they were actually taking an interest in everything around them. I suppose, in a sense, they were reconnecting with nature. And what they noticed most were the birds. They weren't going to see foxes or badgers. There were too many people out and about for that to happen. But there was always birds to be seen. Don Conroy had a great line. If you want to see nature, just look up in the sky. There's always a bird flying by. And it's so true. They had time to enjoy their walk. It wasn't something they had to do. It was something they wanted to do. Just like me.
Terry Flanagan out for a stroll along the banks of the Royal Canal, enjoying the bird song. But what exactly is bird song? And how do birds actually sing?
Right, Derek, just follow me through here. Let's put this down here now.
Niall Hatch is the head of communications and development with conservation charity Birdwatch Ireland and a regular panellist on Mooney Goes Wild.
Very weighty tome, isn't it?
He is.
Don't worry, there's no exam.
Making me nervous.
No, there's no exam. I won't be testing you at the end of it. I just brought this textbook along to show you essentially the fundamental differences between the way that we humans and our fellow mammals produce sound and the way that the birds produce sound when they're singing in the Dawn Chorus. Mm-hmm. Now, we just flick through here to page 238, I think it is. Yep. Okay. You see there we've got two diagrams now. Inside your body, in your throat and in your chest cavity, this is your vocal apparatus, Derek. When I'm speaking to you now, I'm using my larynx, my voice box.
Indeed.
Now you can see on the diagram, it's quite a complicated structure encased in cartilage, a sort of protective mechanism. But essentially what we're talking about, it's vibrating strings. It's a pair of vibrating cords, very much like the strings on a guitar or a violin, that vibrate at a certain frequency and that produces sound. And that's amplified in our chest cavity and projected out through our mouths using the bones of our chest and our skull to project that sound out further. And that's why we sound the way that we do. Now, when I'm talking to you, I have to pause to take breath in to enable me to continue speaking, mm-hmm. because I can only project that sound when I'm actually breathing out. If I try to speak to you when I'm breathing in, it doesn't sound well at all. And that's why the best opera singers and so on spend so long perfecting their breath control so they can sustain those notes and keep that volume for as long as possible. For birds, it's very, very different. Birds, you'll see here the diagram here of their vocal apparatus called a syrinx or a syrinx, whatever you have in yourself. It's very different. You can see here it's really shaped, I suppose, like a pair of pipes in an upside down Y shape. There's a tube up the top and then two pipes coming off at angles at the bottom. They're very much like the pipes in an organ. The birds can control the pitch of their sound by contracting and expanding muscles in the walls of those tubes that change the pitch. And air is blown through and across those, kind of in the way that a flute would produce sound. So rather than having a vibrating string like on a guitar, it's like a woodwind instrument. There's a couple of advantages with that. First of all, there are fewer moving parts. So, you know, if we're at a football match or the Eurovision or whatever it may be, and we're screaming and shouting, it takes its toll on your voice. Your vocal cords will literally swell up. They can be affected. They can, even in extreme circumstances, could be so badly damaged that you couldn't speak. You got a hoarse throat.
Birds, they would be a lot more vocal than we are. They need to keep that voice going at high volume. If they had those moving parts, it wouldn't work. They'd become hoarse very quickly. For the birds, it's much less wear and tear on the vocal apparatus because they're moving air through these tubes. So it's much easier on their bodies in order to, for them to be able to do that. But also, because it's all about the flow of air, it doesn't matter whether that air is moving in or moving out. The birds can sing whether they're breathing in
continuously.
It's continuously. So if you think of a bird like the skylark, a famous songster will rise up high into the sky, can sing for minutes on end, and sometimes people say, well, he's not even pausing for breath. How is that possible? The fact is, he is breathing many times per minute, faster than we are. Just he can sing whether the air is going in or going out. And birds also have a very complicated breathing apparatus. For us, when we breathe, it goes into our lungs and we breathe it back out of our lungs through the same pipe. So we can't actually breathe in and out at the same time. For birds, that's quite different. They can breathe in, then that air passes through air sacs that they have through their bodies and sometimes even inside their bones. It's recirculated, and each new breath pushes that air further around the system. So it actually circulates. It takes four breaths actually for it to circulate completely. So that means that the birds are always pushing air around that system, which means that they can divert that to go through that syrinx to produce that sound. And that's why bird song is so loud and so prominent, and how the birds can spend so much time doing it. The other advantage that they have is that they can actually control those two different tubes independently. We can't do that with our vocal cords. I can just make one sound at a time. A singer can just sing one note. Birds can harmonize with themselves. They can produce more than one note at a time, mm-hmm. which means a much richer sound. You get this wonderful, almost chorusing effect and this harmonizing effect. And that's why a lot of bird song sounds so melodious, and why I suppose it speaks to us in a very particular way that the sounds of other creatures don't. Because it's so complicated, it's very much akin to a premium musical instrument, yeah. and that's really what's going on in the Dawn Chorus. And the Dawn Chorus is an orchestra of all of these different instruments playing at once.
But why do they sing different songs?
Well, each species has to recognise its own kind. So a bird like a robin doesn't care what the local blackbirds or blue tits or wrens are doing. It's not interested in mating with them. It doesn't see them as competition for its territory because they have different needs, different nesting sites, different food resources. It cares very much what's happening with the other robins, for example.
Right.
So they want to be able to identify each other. And also, a lot of the sound that a bird would make, it depends on its own body size. The smaller birds, as a general rule of thumb, tend to sing at a higher pitch than the larger birds do. And this is a way for them to avoid competing over the airways. If you think of it almost like radio stations on a different frequency, you know, we have all these sound waves going around us and radio waves around us all the time. You can tune in to each individual one on your radio. It's very much like that with birds too. Each species, as far as we know, is really only tuned in to the frequency of its own species. So during the Dawn Chorus, you can hear that. You can hear a robin singing at a slightly higher pitch than a blackbird would, for example. The wood pigeon is lower than that. The wren is higher again than that. So it's like the different instruments in an orchestra. The way you can tell the difference between a cello and a violin, or a bassoon and a clarinet. It's very much like that with the birds. So they're only getting the information that they really need as to what's happening with their own species, if there's a threat over the territory. But then also you'll see them tuned in to other vocalizations, like the alarm calls that they would give. You'd find that many of those are on very similar frequencies, because if a blackbird sees danger coming, like a, maybe a hawk or a fox or something, well, that information is interesting to the local robins or song thrushes.
That's
or blue tits.
Very important, yeah.
It's very important. So they will actually tune into that sound.
They know what it means.
They know what it means. And you'll find that those frequencies are more similar than the songs are, because the birds respond to that same sort of frequency band. That's all what's going on with our Dawn Chorus. It's amazing. We think of it as beautiful music. For the birds, though, it's so complex, all going on around us, and we just get to sit back and listen to it. It's beautiful.
The Dawn Chorus is a cause for celebration and a form of entertainment quite unlike any other, as well as a source of comfort and solace in times of challenge. This free natural concert has a unique power to lift us all up and to fill us with hope and optimism.
So my research actually is about people noticing nature and being sensitive to their environment in different ways. So we are all on a spectrum of different levels of sensitivity. Some people are, for example, very bothered by loud noises. Some people are not bothered at all. Some people notice. So, for example, walking by, there is a beautiful magnolia. Some people tend to notice those things more, or bird songs. Some people would tend to notice those things more, and some people less, by default, so to say. So I'm looking at these differences and whether these differences bring well-being differences. So, for example, looking into flourishing and whether people that are more sensitive to their environment flourish more. also I look at pro-nature conservation behavior and pro-environmental behavior and whether this sensitivity to the environment can lead to be more empathic, more sort of in tune with the environment, and therefore to be more inclined to protect it more.
Dr. Annalisa Setti is a lecturer at the School of Applied Psychology in University College Cork.
I should say, although this that I'm looking at, environmental sensitivity, is considered a trait, so in some ways you're kind of born that way, it is also important to state that it's not only people that have this in higher measure, so to say, that can have the benefits of nature. So I'm also looking, for example, we just conducted a study in collaboration between UCC and the University of Bologna, where we looked at student body here and in Bologna and what predicted their well-being, or whether nature contact, noticing nature, paying more attention to nature, having nature available nearby, for example, in UCC on campus, can predict students' well-being. And it does. It does across both campuses. Of course, there are other things that predict your well-being as a student and as a person, for example, your socioeconomic status. But nature plays an important part. So I think that's a nice message that if we have nature available, it is good for us, for sure.
How can you measure this, Annalisa?
In different ways. In my work, I use two types of methods. One is self-report. So, for example, validated scales that measure your flourishing, that measure your current mood or your mood in the past 2 weeks, or, for example, your validated scales that measure your tendency to ruminate on things, how much you go on about negative thinking. You can also use more sort of experimental methods where you would have people doing tasks, for example, and see how fast they are or how sharp is their attention. And that would be my work. And then there is epidemiological work that looks at health impacts, for example. There was actually a recent study coordinated by Ireland, but the study was run in Spain, and they looked across a number of European cities how many deaths could be prevented if the WHO guidelines about the distance from nature where you live and how available is nature to you would be followed. So if you had nature nearby, actually a number of deaths could be prevented.
And do birds feature at all?
I suppose that they are one of those features of nature, of that biodiversity that really captures the richness of the natural environment. So we were mentioning scales before, so I was working on a scale that looks at pathways to nature, and the first question that we had in that scale was actually, do you listen to bird songs? Do you seek, you know, to go out and watch, do bird watching? So it is really an important feature of the environment. And actually, they seem to have some level of special status. It was reported in the news today talking about listening to bird songs and nature sounds at bedtime could actually help sleep. And there is a whole literature beyond that that shows really that birds and biodiversity, but especially bird songs, have an important role in our well-being. So I think it is an interesting aspect. And on the other end, years ago, I gathered with a colleague of mine the literature on aging and nature, and we wrote a review. And within this review, what we found is that, for example, if you live in a place where there is a lot of noise, so you don't have access to bird songs, you don't have access to this biodiversity, or you're less likely to, you actually have, for example, more higher likelihood of cognitive decline. So there are big implications for these things. And in the traditional literature on nature restoration, for example, a lot of emphasis has been given to visual features of the environment. And I think birds, of course, are also, you may see them, and they're a visual feature, but they're a very multisensory feature. So with their song, they give something that is special, and there is probably more research to be done in that sense.
birdsong speaks to us in a way like nothing else on Earth, just as it did to our ancestors, generation by generation, right back to the dawn of our own species and beyond.
I once did a talk to kids, fourth class, so about 10-year-old, and I was talking to them about birdsong, and it was in the inner city of Dublin. And the teacher said, let's Google the song of a blackbird. And this little kid at the back put his hand up and said, teacher, why don't we just go outside and listen? I was struck by this kid's thinking, because we are so stuck at looking at nature, you know, on big plasma screens or listening to the Dawn Chorus on the radio. Sometimes we need to go outside and listen.
But just what is it about birdsong that captivates and inspires us? This is a question that naturalist, author and broadcaster Eric Dempsey has long pondered.
This kid said something even more profound, because I was interested in his thinking and I said, what's the difference? We're still going to hear the blackbird. And his answer was possibly the most profound answer I was ever given. He said, we might hear it, but we won't feel it. And that is nature encapsulated in one small sentence. We won't feel it, because nature is something that you feel. The Dawn Chorus is something that I don't just hear or I don't just listen to, but I feel it. Nature is an emotional thing for me. People mark time in many different ways, be it, you know, the passing of a year in January, you know, 1st, or the, you know, New Year's Eve, or they mark time, you know, with their birthday. They feel we've survived another year. Another year has passed. But for me, it's not about a date like the 1st of January or my birthday. It's the arrival of song into my world. It's the arrival of sound, of nature waking up. And it stirs something very primal in me. I often think that our ancestors who struggled to survive each winter wake up and hear birds singing. It's a feeling that they've survived another winter. And that's sort of how I feel about birdsong. I've survived another year. The winter is gone. And like my ancestors, generations of ancestors before me, I listen to birdsong and I'm filled with the fact that spring has at last arrived. And when I listen to a migrant bird arriving back into Ireland, as I'm speaking, there was a willow warbler singing there and a chiffchaff. Migrant birds that have travelled thousands of kilometres. That little willow warbler, 10 grams, and there he is at the very top of a tree singing. And these birds have achieved incredible things. That little willow warbler singing has crossed the Sahara Desert and he's reached his ancestral home. He was possibly born here in Ireland. I'm filled with awe at the achievement of these birds. I would urge everybody this year not just to go out and listen to the Dawn Chorus. Close your eyes. Let the sound flow over you. Don't just listen to it, but feel it.
I'm often asked how many birds will participate in the Dawn Chorus each morning. And the honest answer is that nobody really knows. What we can say is that here in Ireland at least, roughly 70 species of bird can be considered to be amongst the key performers across various different habitats, though many other species will make their own vocal contributions, albeit in perhaps not so aesthetically pleasing a manner, to human ears at least. Some of those species are represented by millions of individuals on this island alone. Wrens and chaffinches, for example, are thought to outnumber human beings in Ireland. Include the hundreds of additional bird species that sing at dawn across Europe, than the thousands more across the remainder of the Northern Hemisphere and in the tropics. And you are talking about literally billions of individual birds bursting into song as the sun rises in May. All part, as Richard Collins has said, of an unceasing ensemble performance encircling the globe. In an Irish dawn chorus, some species tend to be much more prominent and widespread than others. All have names, of course, bestowed on them by humans. But the birds themselves don't know that. The bird you are hearing here has no idea that some people call it a blackbird. Others, merle noir. Others, amsel. Others, turdus merula. Or indeed, osquelga, lundolf for the male and kershock for the female. The Irish language names of many of our Star Dawn Chorus performers have some interesting origins.
No, you're at the door.
Derek, how are you?
I'm grand.
Good to see you.
Were you standing there waiting for me?
Well, I thought I saw a car drawing up. I have a glass door, you see, and I can see through
it.
Oh,
I see, very good.
There's lovely flowers on it.
I'll do an Honduras, I suppose.
Well, it would be a help to keep the heat in.
Where are we going? Into the sitting room or what?
No, Derek, we're going to my study. Come upstairs with me and I'll show you.
All these years, Ada, my God.
Yeah, no, I'm afraid I have to trade in my etchings. I only have books now.
Susan Styra.
Oh, my own book. Arailiganish. Trastan Shaw. August Ischi on Shaw.
Is this whole interview going to be Osquelga, Ada?
Who better to tell us about the origins of these names, Osquelga, than our very own Ana Nilauna?
I suppose Irish people have always known about birds. I was looking at my old books. Not that the books are old, but they're written long ago. I have this one here now called The Natural History of Ireland. Look at it here by Philip O'Sullivan Bear. It was actually written in the late 1600s. Mm-hmm. Because O'Sullivan Bear was one of the Sullivans at the Battle of Kinsale after that in the 1600s. And he wrote this thing when he was in Spain about the wildlife in Ireland. And he wrote it in, you'd be glad to know, he wrote it in Latin, he wrote it in English, Irish and Spanish.
Well, he was living in Spain.
Well, all of those things. So there's a whole lot of the names of birds in it and the names of everything else there was in Ireland at the time. And then I have this one here. It's called The Experienced Huntsman by Arthur Stringer. And this was written in 1798. And he was an Ulster man who went around hunting things. And he refers to various birds and animals and things that were... Oh, that he was killing and chopping up and doing all sorts of things about it. But it's gas the way they all have different approaches to things, and what they're saying about the birds then is not what we know now. I mean, did they observe things and they put different interpretations on
them?
But
were they all calling them by the same name?
Well, they were all calling them by the same name.
Well, give me a few examples.
Well, I mean, if you think something just as simple, say, as the blackbird, for example. In Irish, it's an lundov, and because Irish people realised that there were male and female, the female was the kershock, the two names for that. And, of course, then there was a whole lot of things about an Irish saying that the blackbirds don't sing in night time, they don't sing in the evening time, they sing in the morning time. So this observation of this, the kershock then was the female. She was more sort of tidy and sat on the nest and kept her mouth shut and behaved as a woman should, I expect, indeed. If we think of maybe the more common birds, the wren, for example, everybody knows that's called an drolin. But dro is actually such an old word, such an old Irish word, it means it's the druid's bird. Now, the druids were here before Christianity, so we're going away back to the 4th and 5th century AD with that name because it was the druid's bird. And the druid, because the wren was able to speak so fast and sing so fast, they reckoned it was able to have the power of forecasting. It could tell you things that were going to happen in the future. So, like, there was a great lot of mystery associated with that. I mean, this idea of Stephen's Day and the wren boys and all the rest mm-hmm. of it, that's associated with Christ and Christianity and betraying him and stuff. That's later. I mean, the wren goes way back to even before those times, even to the druids, and the name is the same name, Drolin, Een, adding an Een on it, a small Bucaline, Kyleen, little things. So Drolin is the little bird of
and
Doctor.
It is.
So now I told you about the blackbird, mm-hmm. the one that everybody knows and will be the first one probably to sing in the dawn chorus.
Because of its big eye.
That's right, it sees delight and that's what does it. And of course we have the wren with its high-pitched and two 200 notes a second. Everybody knows that one. But suppose the one that most people will actually hear will be the robin, because there are robin in 99.9% of people's gardens.
According to the Garden Bird Survey,
well,
yes.
Indeed. So if you're lying in bed with the window open, you'll hear the robin. And of course, robins were well known to Irish people. They called it on Spidjog, which is the Irish name for it, or Spidjog, you know, Cray of Jarrog sometimes, you know, to say that it has a red breast as well. But it is actually very well interwoven with Irish folklore and the idea that, you know, people who are dead come back as robins. So if you see, and robins, of course, are tame and come into the house. So people would take consolation on seeing a robin in the house, because it means that the person who has died very close to them, a spouse maybe or a child, has come back to console them or to give them a message or to say that they're doing all right. So robins in the house, I mean, oftentimes birds in the house are supposed to signify a death, but not a robin. A robin is a return of someone to say that they're doing all right in the next world. And that's something that people like. So the robin is very much a welcome bird. So great respect for, always for the robin on Spidjog. So the Irish knew the wildlife in the way that they needed to know it for how it actually affected their own lives. So great stuff there, Derek. We've always known about na Hanley in Ireland.
To paraphrase Shakespeare, a bird by any other name would sound as sweet. Indeed, that would be the case even if it had no name at all. But we humans have a compulsion to bestow names onto things and to try to impose a sense of order upon the natural world. One man who has a particular fascination with the origin of bird names is Stephen Moss, one of the UK's leading broadcasters and television producers. Stephen is also a celebrated naturalist and author of numerous books about wildlife. One of these, entitled Mrs. Moreau's Warbler, is all about how bird species came to be given the English language names we know them by today. Some of which have been named after their distinctive songs.
There's some very well-known bird names that are onomatopoeic. There's one in my garden singing today, the chiff-chaff, which is returning now to Britain and Ireland from North Africa, although some of them do actually spend the winter now. And the chiff-chaff simply sings its name. The male chiff-chaff sings chiff, chiff, chaff, chiff, chaff. The other one we're waiting for, which hopefully will arrive in the next week or so, although they're now getting very rare, is, of course, the cuckoo, probably the most famous onomatopoeic bird name, a bird named after the sound it makes. But even the crows, which of course we do see, crow and rook and raven, are all onomatopoeic names. They all derive, they're if you like, a sort of version of what prehistoric human beings would have originally heard.
What about the corncrake?
Corncrake, of course, is onomatopoeic. The Latin scientific name for corncrake, found in the west of Ireland, of course, a very secretive bird, is Crex crex. So the English name and the scientific name are both reflecting of its very strange, repetitive, craking call.
Each year we strive to bring as many different bird species as possible to the listeners. A good example is the corncrake, a species that was once so widespread across Ireland that its highly distinctive song, mostly performed at night, would have needed no introduction.
Across Ireland, we have less than 200 calling male birds recorded, and the calling males are a proxy for the entire population. So, you know, for every calling male corncrake, you probably have a female as well. So conservatively, that means there's 400 birds in the entire country. 400. That is so, so sad, because at one point these birds were found in every farm across the country, and people still remember this. This isn't in time immemorial. This is within our lifetime. People of my dad and mum's generation will remember the corncrakes everywhere. Corncrakes in Ireland are now only found here in North and West Donegal and the Mullet Peninsula and parts of Galway. So they've lost so much of their range. It's quite sad.
Dr. John Carey is project manager of Corncrake Life, a European Union-funded initiative which works with farmers and landowners to improve habitat for these remarkable birds in Ireland's special protection area network and surrounding farmland.
The corncrake is a remarkable farmland bird, because you never see a corncrake, but you hear it. And its voice is singular in nature. There's nothing else that quite sounds like a corncrake. And it is the call of the corncrake that For people who grew up with the corncrake, it's instantly recognisable. Mm. There's nothing else like it, and it heralds the beginning of the summer. Many of us know the cuckoo, many of us will know the grasshopper warbler is another bird I love, but it really is the corncrake. Its voice, it's like a bell ringing in the landscape. It draws your attention to it. It cuts through everything else that's going on. Whether we're listening to the wind here, which is pulling in from the north today and it's particularly cold, we can hear the surf to the south of us. We can even hear the skylark singing. But if that corncrake calls right now, we're just going to shut up because he commands the soundscape.
Now you say he.
It is the male bird that calls, and the female is the silent partner in all of this. Female corncrakes do call, and it's an unusual kind of a mewing call. The females generally call if there's no males around, which is a really poor sign. Females might also call if there's a lot of females and they get territorial. But it is the male corncrake. It is his voice you hear. When he's calling at this time of the year, he's proclaiming his territory. He's holding on to territory. He's telling the other birds, you know, this is my spot now, stay away. And he will attract other males and they will challenge each other. And we have seen them and have footage of them absolutely knocking lumps out of each other. They're not passive creatures at all. They can be highly aggressive. But that disyllabic crake, that creks, creks call, you will hear it during the day if you're lucky, but it's at night it really comes alive. Well, somewhere around 10 or 11 o'clock in the evening, when they're really at high dough and their hormones have kicked in, they start calling. And he will call 10 to 15,000 times, keeping the whole townland awake with this really loud call.
Oshkoelga, of course, in this part of the world. Oshkoelga.
And it's an interesting point, Derek, because what we've recently discovered through our research with ATU and our PhD student, Andrea Peresi, corncrakes actually do have kind of regional accents, regional dialects. And we always suspected that, you know, it was always there. But now the evidence is showing it. So we have so much to learn about these birds, their bioacoustics, and what that means for them and how we can maybe use that to help conserve them.
Since 2002, we have broadcast the sounds of the Dawn Chorus live from Birdwatch Ireland's Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve near Cove in County Cork. It's not a location that was chosen by accident, but rather it was selected for a very specific reason. And the man who did so was local ornithologist and broadcaster Jim Wilson.
Well, Derek, when you come in onto the reserve, which is a private reserve here in Kuskany Marsh, the first impression would be, I don't think this is going to be a great place for recording a dawn chorus. Because it's just like a laneway up to somebody's house, and there's not much going on at the moment. But that's the whole thing. We're in mid-March at the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, a couple of kilometres, 2 kilometres from the centre of Cove, city's harbour is outside, city's up there. And you're kind of going, would it not be better to go out somewhere, you know, like miles from any houses and habitation? I said, no, because the secret of it is all the habitats we've got so close together. And for every habitat, you have a certain menu of birds. And it's the combination of all of them that gives us such a broad range of sounds for the dawn chorus.
In such close proximity.
Absolutely. Literally, if I shout loud enough, you could probably hear me on the beach. There's a strand just down there. And between me and you on the beach, we've got a little meadow area. We've got a lagoon. We've got a reed bed. And then you've got, here we are in what is effectively what we call a wet woodland, a car woodland of alders and stuff like that. And then behind us, we've actually got a stand of conifers as well. So you've got a deciduous woodland, coniferous woodland. Then you've also got freshwater streams. So that also adds another habitat. And this is what it's all about. It's all about finding a place where we can pretty much set up in the one spot and the habitats come to us practically. So we have all our habitats. And yeah, you can hear the cars in the background. You can hear the hum of the harbour outside. But that's part of our landscape now. And yet it does not stop the birds from giving us this amazing chorus. And that's all that matters in the end of the day.
Wherever you happen to live, the dawn chorus is there for you. Remember, no matter what is going on in our lives, through the good times and the bad, as long as the world keeps turning, the birds will always sing.